हरि ओम सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सहवीर्यंकरवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सदि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
So chapter 16, page 3. Chapter 16 summarizes questions and answers. Question 21. Question 21 is asked by Shaunaka Rishi of Suta Goswami. Why did Maharaj Parikit simply punish but not kill the personality of Kali, since he was the lowest of the Shudras, having dressed as a king and having struck a cow on the leg? Suta Goswami answers Shaunaka's question in the next chapter. Question 22 of Srimad Bhagavatam is asked by the bull, Dharma, to the cow, the earth. Question 22. After making a chain of inquiries about the welfare of the cow that links together many anomalies of the age of Kali, the bull requests, please inform me of the root cause of your tribulations by which you have been reduced to such a weak state. I think that the powerful influence of time, which conquers the most powerful, might have forcibly taken away all your fortune, which was adored even by the demigods. 19-24. The cow, Bhumi, answers question 22 in verses 25-35. Some of your answers are cited in the purport to verse 25. The principles of religion are laid down by the Lord Himself, and the executor of such laws is Dharmaraj or Yamaraj. Such principles work fully in the age of Satyayuga. In the Treta Yuga, they are reduced by a fraction of one-fourth. In the Dwapara Yuga, they are reduced to one-half. In the Kali Yuga, they are reduced to one-fourth, gradually diminishing to the zero point. And then devastation takes place. Happiness in the world depends proportionally on the maintenance of the religious principles, individually or collectively. Yeah. So here this point that the happiness that one will get, Prabhupada mentioned, happiness in the world depends proportionally on the maintenance of the religious principles. It doesn't say something else. You maintain the religious principles, you can be happy. You don't maintain them, you can't be happy. There's no question you can be happy outside of that. Right? Means there's always the idea that I get something I want, I will be happy, but that happiness we see is only for a moment. So for that continuous state of being happy, one must be following the principles of religion. Right? Because religion means what's the inherent nature of something. Right? And the inherent nature of something, then if it's dealt with in that way, it responds properly. You don't, it won't. Right? The tendency these days is religion is simply taken as basically a particular faith. You know, in the Lord or not, or, you know, some particular faith, and the particular, you know, specific rituals that go along with it in the form of worship or respect. So it's been reduced down to that. So that's why Dharma becomes very difficult to understand, because Dharma means the inherent nature you can't change. Right? So again, this whole modern idea is that anybody will do anything because they feel like it is against religious principles, because you can't change it just because you feel like it. Right? It means, it's just like this. If we were working on feel like it, how many little kids would be flying around? You know, riding on unicorns. You know, and even better yet, a flying unicorn, right? You know, and then when they would go, you know, how many houses would still be standing on the block? You know, because they'd take their stick and hit it and the whole house would fall over. You understand? You know, how many girls would have already been married about 3,259 times by the time they're 12? You know, Prince Charming, you know, can you imagine? They would have to widen the roads to get all the Prince Charmings in on their white horses. You know what I'm saying? And then who's got the space for the royal wedding? You understand? So that's the whole point, is it going on? No, that's happening because of desire. We'll say, well, that's childish. So just because now you're above 18, it's not childish anymore? You know what I'm saying? Let's say the kid drops the glass, right? It hits the floor. It breaks. Okay. Add 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years onto that. Drop the glass. What happens? Exactly the same thing. In fact, there's a possibility. The kid's only dropping it for about 2 feet. The adult's dropping it for about 5 feet. Right? So definitely it will spread more. It'll make more trouble. So this idea is, no, is that kids are childish. Adults are just as childish. The problem is just they have a bit of an ego to go along with it. You understand? So this principle is very, very important. Because there is no way to become happy outside of following the religious principles. So religious principles means the religion of everything. Right? Yes.
Thank you. In regards to doing the needful and surrendering, like yes. We can see in this movement, we have plenty of examples of people who were, materially speaking, totally unqualified right. For the functions and positions and jobs that they did, but because of their surrender and also because of mercy, they were capable to pulling it off. Maybe not on the long run. So how
well,
do we adopt that, and how does the transition look like to an ideal or more conducive state of functioning?
The difference, the transition happens because of knowledge. Right? So when there's knowledge and detachment, then one can apply the Vedic principles very
easily. The element of surrender? Still
surrender, of course, means it's just like this. The smarta follows it, the smartas are happy. Why are the smartas happy as smartas? Because they're happy. Right? You get conditioned by the mode of goodness. So they're comfortable like that, even though everybody else around them is not doing what they're doing. But they have a happiness they can see that others don't have. So they continue doing it. So the point is functioning in the mode of goodness always brings that result. Now you do that connected to Krishna, now you get the transcendental along with it. The devotional develops. Now for us, of course, we're not coming from these pious backgrounds necessarily. So therefore, it's only through the power of bhakti we have the ability to be involved in these pious endeavors. So therefore, the devotee who's not necessarily qualified, he can do it because of his surrender. But that's the key. As long as you're surrendered, you can work in that emergency mode. As soon as then you have ego, then it's not going to work. Now, in here, again, we're only looking at ourself, my surrender and everything. What it was, means that's included in this element of nature, because the point is that you're making is they don't have the nature to necessarily do those things, so the qualifications. So how are they doing it? Because emergency and surrender, Krishna gives that ability. So that does have to be addressed. But the other is how are they working with the material energy? If they don't work with the material energy according to the nature of material energy, it still won't work. So that's the whole point, is that the weakness comes is that the concept of nature that is inherent, that is unchangeable, is not a concept that is basically there in the Western mentality. Right? Especially in the, means you have it in the European, you'll have it in the, you know, the Asia. Basically you could say the European understands it's there, the rest of the world understands it's there, America has this idea, if I just want it, I can get it. Right? So that's a weakness, is fine. You can, if you want it, you can get it, as long as you follow the rules. Because if we look at it, there are a few well-publicized success stories in the American scene. But how many unsuccessful stories are there? You know, so the point is why are they unsuccessful? They're not following the laws. You follow the laws, you get results. You don't follow the laws, you don't get results. So you have to be aware of what the laws are. What is the nature? So this idea is, no, we can do anything. Okay, but the interesting thing is this, on this, I've heard this, that means probably because it's topical, right? But it's you know, you hear it in the ether, that you have two opposing aspects of this same point being questioned. And the interesting thing is even though they're opposing, they're generally used to support each other, right? You know, so somehow or another, the darkness supports the light, right? So, you know, however it works. So one is the one you mentioned, that I as an individual have been, means either I'm engaged according to ways I'm not supposed to be, or others are engaged not in the way they're supposed to be. And then the other thing is we're not that conditioning anyway, so therefore, as the soul, I can do anything I want. Does that make sense? So on both sides, the weakness is the not actually understanding the principle of what Dharma is. If that's understood, then one can approach and in those areas of value to oneself, then one can contemplate and see religion. Because you don't have to see religion in everything, other than Krishna's in everything. You only have to see it in those areas that you have to work with. Right? You know, I don't have to worry about, you know, some kid, you know, out on the street in southern Vietnam, you know, selling lemon juice. What's his economic, you know, how is his economics going? I have to worry about what's in the circle of my influence. Does that make sense? So, therefore, the values that I have, I see religion in connection with that. That is what I can apply. I can't apply someone else's. So if that's, and so to get that, that's by knowledge and training and, you know, association. In other words, knowledge gained in association. So through the process of that discussion, that vichar, then it can be appreciated. Because we see it's quite a complex subject. Bhishma and Drona, Kripa, they couldn't give an answer to Draupadi because religion is so complicated. But at the same time, it's because of being maintained by Duryodhana, their intelligence was clouded. Because otherwise, if they weren't, they could have easily seen what should have been done. You know, because Vikarna was also maintained by Duryodhana's grains, but he could see this is nonsense. You know, but that's one king out of thousands. So the point is by devotion, the intelligence becomes clear. And then in that state, if we want to know, then we can. If we don't want to know, then Krishna won't reveal, like we were reading yesterday. The demons, they're killed by Krishna, but if they don't know that he's Krishna, they don't get liberation. Like that. But if they know he's Krishna by being attracted to him, then they get liberation. You know? So therefore, if you don't want to know Krishna being knowledge, remembrance and forgetfulness, you won't know. It's that simple. Because otherwise, how is it in 40 years, in something that's practically in every, you know, second or third purport, devotees haven't made the effort to understand other than how to oppose it? That means there's not a desire to know. Otherwise, I've seen somebody wants to know, let's say, something technical like astrology. Now, that's technical. It's math. It's you know, it's really a crunch. But in 1.5-2 years, they become, you know, fairly well-based in it by putting their attention into it. You know, like that. And they're actually able to do. Give more time, they get more experience, they can work. But here, somehow or another, it's not. It's said 10,000 hours, then you become, you know, expert at something. So, how many experts are there? That means not a lot of hours have been put in. Right? Some are expert at opposing it. If they would think about how to apply it as much as they thought of how to oppose it, they'd probably be quite good at it. Applying it, of course. Is that?
Yeah, so in Kali Yuga, most people are mixed.
Yes.
So then their occupation and their engagements would also be mixed, or should they try to follow their primary quality and then it's more
it's easier.
Successful or satisfying
yes.
or
the you happiness take the, is the main, greater. You take the main one and you support it with the others. And if they're not, there's always situations in which the other one runs on its own. So in other words, what's compatible, you use them together, but know which is primary and which is not, then you do it in different situations.
And in times of emergency and in times of necessity, you just have to...
You do the needful.
Do what's
but the point is it shouldn't be thought, well, that worked great, so we'll just keep on emergency mode. Like I mentioned, we were talking yesterday, is that previously there was one marathon a year, and then everyone would try to be involved in it. Now some yatras have 7 marathons a year, and only like 4 or 5 people are involved, and no one else ever thinks about getting involved at all. So it hasn't improved by improving, you know. In other words, the emergency works, you know, nicely for a short period of time, and then everybody can get involved. As soon as you make emergency prominent, 70% is, you know, 70, you know, 7 months out of 12 is quite prominent. It's more than half. So therefore, it no longer becomes something available to everybody. So it's not emergency anymore. It becomes occupation for a handful. Does that make sense? So that's the whole thing, is that if we think that worked great, yes, it worked great because it was an emergency, but now we have to get back to normal. Because devotees love using the word sustainable. So sustainable means varnashram. It's the only thing that's sustainable. Nothing else is sustainable. Otherwise, the culture that's there now is very different than it was a few years ago. We talk about modern, but it's not the same as it was before. In other words, now in the what do you call them now? We were in the knots, the teens, kind of. Then the mentality, general mentality of the people is totally different than was before. It's a new generation. So what they talk, what they think is very different. So even the mentality within the knots is accessible to them. But you go back to the 90s, it's starting to get, you know, they haven't even heard about it. You go back farther than that, that's like ancient. You know, one can say, but it's only a few years. But people who lived in the 60s, they didn't relate, except for the bohemian element, to the 50s. Right? You know, like that. And then, you know, the hippies didn't relate to the punks. You know? Now it's like punks are more prominent than hippies. And the hippies grow up, and then they're going to... Right. So, and then the 40s, you know, who's in the swing? You know, then the 30s, then the 20s. You know, it's 40 years. So 40 years back, you can't work, you can't use it. If you're talking modern. But somehow or another, everyone gets stuck in their own time warp and think it's eternal. But it's not. It's totally different. I cannot use examples that I used 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I could use certain examples. Now I use them, no one knows what I'm talking about. It's just the exposure is so different. And so we have to be very, very careful, is that knowledge means you have to actually take what's here. Vedic is eternal. Vedic is universal. They're trying to take it that Vedic is Indian, so therefore Vedic is just as limited as American, but of the two, Americans actually more, you know, New World Order. But if we notice, America is more and more becoming, immigrants are from the third world countries, so the New World Order is Asia. You know, like that. You know, I'm throwing a good shot of South America and in Haribo. You know, like that. I guess you could throw in the Caribbean also. You know, but you know, that's the way it is. So this whole idea that you're going to educate yourself, but in what is modern, but modern changes. You educate yourself on what's Vedic, then that's universal. Prabhupada can work with anybody from the highest, you know, government ministers down to, you know, go out and take a, what do you call it? Those putty knife, right? And go out, you know, walk out of the door, go across the sidewalk. When you get to the street, it drops down a little bit. There's that place where the water goes. Take your putty knife, scrape there, and then when you get out of that, then start preaching to it. Right? So Prabhupada could deal with that whole range. Why? Because he knew the Vedic culture. But if you know American, basically anyone other than Americans think Americans are terrible. Seriously. And within America, each one thinks that the other is different. Southerners don't like Northerners, Northerners don't like Southerners, nobody likes West Coast, and West Coast doesn't like anybody else. You know, so hey, you know. I mean, it's like a... Well, actually, West Coast just doesn't care. It's not that you can think about it. That takes more brains, right? So that's the whole point, is education. Devotees are willing to educate them in the modern, but they're not willing to educate them in the Vedic. You know, Prabhupada talked about, when he was present, education. Satsurupa was the only one who did it. That was it. He was the only one. And you see, he turned out some really, really good people. You know, Niranjan Mars is from his training. What's his name? Sesha Prabhu. Gentleman. Good preacher, stable, steady, honest, trustworthy, consistent.
What was his program? How did he train people?
He started the Bhakti Shastri. So the original Bhakti Shastri, dealing with people, training people, you know, the emphasis on culture. And you see, he got results. So many others, you know. So it's special. So he you know, took it up what Prabhupada wanted. The others were too busy doing what you said, being practical.
Building empires.
That's another thing. But they were just being practical. Like that. And so then, because of that, then everything always working on emergency, then not. So to that degree that the person understood, to that degree it works. And you can see it now. Whoever follows that, it works. Who doesn't follow it, it doesn't work. It's that's the point here, is that happiness in the world depends proportionately. That means it's math, it's science. It's not just a whimsical thing. It's science. So that degree they follow it, to that degree it works. Like that. It's actually very direct. And yes.
Proportionally, individually.
Yes.
Some devotees do follow collectively.
They don't. So it won't work in collectively, but it'll work individually. Yes. Point is, you apply it, it'll work for you.
Yes.
If a group of people who are applying it get together, then you have a community, then it works for them. Like that. So it's just, the point is sense. See, personally, we don't really care about how well the material world runs.
Yes.
That's not actually our interest. But since we have to work with it, might as well work with superior ingredients. Right? If all the time you're having to deal with devotees bickering and fighting and can't get along and this and that, then where's the time for sitting down and discussing Krishna consciousness and how to actually spread Krishna consciousness? Right? So that's why then we take care of it. You know, a stitch in time saves nine. Right? So in other words, you deal with it when it's small, then it doesn't get big, and then it's a very minor management, and then you can do, you know, important management like Krishna consciousness. But if it's not done, then the focus is on the material. If it's not according to Dharma, it won't work. It just won't work. I've heard devotees talking about, you know, what is this, you know, strategic planning since the mid-90s. Where is it?
It's still planning.
Okay, strategic planning means you just plan. The plan is you plan. Okay, you know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing. But the point is in less time than that, Prabhupada started from nothing, with nothing, to 108 temples and seriously something. You know, say what you want. You know, oh, he's the pure devotee of this and that. But the point is why? He followed these things. So Krishna's blessing, as Prabhu was mentioning. Devotees went out. You took a handful of hippies, you know, who, you know, basically would listen a lot to the Beatles. You know, so even to see them at a concert would be great. To meet them would be even greater. But to live in their house and preach to them? It's like, what hippie ever had that opportunity? Zero. Right? But then, here's this handful of hippies. They're doing that. That's what he's talking about. Where's the qualification? But they're doing it. Because of Krishna's grace. So that's the point. You apply it, it works. You don't apply it, it doesn't matter how qualified and intelligent you are, it's not going to work. It's just the way it is. You know, you bring our man in the wheelchair like that, and how you say, and give him a machine, and you know, this is the on button, and he pushes a button that's not the on button, it won't go on, even though he's the most intelligent quantum physicist on the planet. And he can say, no, but I'm so intelligent, there's something wrong with this machine, this and that. He can say whatever he likes. It won't work. You push the right button, it works. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, okay, he's got a wheelchair. What if we put square wheels on it? Not so good. What about octagonal? Better, but still a bit bumpy. You know what I'm saying? There's laws. That's all. It's just the way it is. We talk laws, we talk science, but we don't want to follow the laws. Unless they support what we're doing, then everybody's got to follow them. If they don't, then, you know, I don't have to follow them. You know, and since I'm not following, I would feel bad if others did, so therefore nobody should follow. Yes?
Maharaj, yesterday you say that to work with others, we need to know them. And to know them, we need to know ourselves.
Yes. Yes. If you don't know who you are, how do you work with someone else? Just like an adult is talking to a child. How do you talk? How do you deal? You know, does the adult stand there, standing up straight, going, this is insulting, you know, you're not, you know, why aren't you looking me, you know, eye to eye? Right? Adults, when they talk to kids, they generally, you know, get down, you know, bend over, get down on the knees, depending upon what height they are. You know, or sometimes pick them up and put them on something taller. You know, stick them on the table, then you can talk, you know. Okay, let's have a man-to-man talk here. You know, stick them on the table, now you can talk eye to eye, right? But the point is you have to know that, otherwise how do you deal? What language do you use? Right? You know, you use language they can understand. That's understanding you're an adult, they're a kid. If you think you're a kid, then it's not going to work. If you think they're adult, it's not going to work. So the point is, if you don't know who you are, you cannot make something work. Like that. Means according to your karma and skills, you'll be able to make those areas work. And if you're surrendered to Krishna, then those areas will work. But as long as you surrender. When you're not surrendered, then they may stop working. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So you said that people can function on the level of emergency if they are surrendered and free from false ego.
That's on a longer period of time. Anyone can do it for a short period of time, right? Just like we mentioned yesterday. If there's a fire in the apartment building, then people can do something about it even though they're not firemen, right? But it's not that they're going to do that every day.
But shouldn't they be surrendered and free from false ego all the time?
That's there. We're talking about, you have to understand, is that on a very short time, anyone can do anything, right? You know, it's just like the car is sitting on top of their kid. There are cases where moms pick up a car, right? A 2-ton car, they pick it up, right? They have problem carrying the groceries out to the car, right? Picking it up out of the little push thingy and putting it into the back of the car, and they're complaining. They pick up a 2-ton car, right? But that's not something now they're going to do as a regular thing. They're going to go join, you know, Cirque Soleil, you know, and then, you know, do some amazing stuff now or something like that, you know. It's just not going to happen, you know, or go down and win the, you know, how many weightlifters can lift that much, right? So they're not going to go down and wear the world records in, you understand? So emergency, anyone can do anything, but the point is, devotees are able to do beyond that because of their surrender. So then they're empowered.
So then why aren't they surrendered and empowered for a long period of time?
No, the empowered is connected with surrendered. It's just like, you know, it's like you pay the money, you get the results.
Yeah.
So you pay and surrender, you get the empowerment.
But why aren't they able to maintain that over a long period of time?
It's their own desire. It's not someone else's business to surrender, it's ours. We don't surrender because of being distracted by material desire. Does that make sense? So when we start giving that up by the practice of devotional service, then that surrender becomes consistent. That's what nishtha means. The surrender is consistent.
So So you're saying that most people, because they're not on that level, therefore they...
It's not about most people. It's about the principle here. Right? We only address a specific generic area that Prabhu asked. But we're not being specific here. It's generic. Like Prabhupada says, happiness in the world depends proportionally on the maintenance of the religious principles. It's just a principle. So as you're surrendered, it works. But the point is it's not about working in emergency mode. It's about engaging yourself in Krishna's service. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the rough, the ready, the hard, the tough, the impossible, that's not where you have to focus. You have to focus on what you have to do. Right? Always remember Krishna, never forgetting him. For the conditioned soul, that's the impossible. Right? Not at the external. That's not where the focus should be. The focus is on the consciousness.
I'm just thinking it will make a lot of temple presidents really happy if everyone did do that, because then they could just put anyone in his spot.
Yeah, but it would also make Prabhupada and the Acharyas happy if that temple president would actually learn what Prabhupada is talking about, and learn the nature of people, and so he could engage them according to their tendency. That's actually the Krishna conscious program.
I agree.
You understand? That's the actual program. So it's not about... It's about making temple presidents happy who are making Prabhupada happy. That's your point. And so even if you don't make the... means you do your best to make the temple president happy. As long as Prabhupada's happy, it works. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the point is it's individual. You're trying to please Prabhupada. The temple president's trying to please Prabhupada. You know, so if you do what the temple president says, whether it's your nature or not, and you sincerely try, it'll work for you. You'll spiritually advance. It doesn't mean that materially you'll get the results desired. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the point is you have the spiritual, you have the material. We're talking here, religious principles means how the world works. Right? Wheels are round. They have a nature of rolling. That's their good point. But then the weak point is you stop something with wheels on a hill. If you don't have a brake, or you know, put a brick or something in front of the wheel, it will roll down the hill. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, so how you say? Luggage with four wheels on, it's great if you're on flat ground. You know, as soon as you stop somewhere where there's a slope, then it's a problem. You understand? So you have to know the nature of something.
So where does what you're saying, fit into that you have to be more humble than a blade of grass and more tolerant?
That's what you're supposed to do. You're doing your duties. And then the temple president, that's his duties. You don't worry about him. You worry about you. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the point.
If everyone was doing everything according to Krishna's laws...
Right.
Would we have to chant Hare Krishna?
Yes, because that's one of the laws.
Okay.
That's the primary law.
But I mean, if we were...
Because what we're talking here is just piety.
Yes.
We're just talking piety. In other words, here we're discussing dharma. Now, of course, within dharma, the full explanation is sad-dharma, which means the nature of the soul. You have to consider that when you're considering the nature of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Right, just like, let's say, I am sitting in the living room. Okay, it's 3 in the afternoon, no one's at home. How loud can the television be on? Right? Quite loud. So you can really crank it up, and you can sit in the kitchen and iron. You know, and, you know, be cooking whatever you're cooking. Right? Now, let's say it's 9 o'clock at night, and the young kids are asleep. Now what?
Yes, no.
You understand? So you have to consider these layers of things. So, in other words, the first thing is sad-dharma, the nature of the soul, a servant of Krishna.
Yes.
So what's the soul going to do? The soul is chanting Hare Krishna. The second thing, what we've been discussing now for the last some bit, that's about the conditioned nature. It means the nature of the body and the mind.
Yes.
And so, if you don't follow that, it still won't get you success. Because it's God's laws all the way around.
I was just thinking you would be chanting as you did everything, and you'd be conscious of everything as Krishna, that maybe you didn't have to actually meditate like on Krishna.
But why wouldn't you? If you like somebody, you'd meditate.
You know, I guess you would.
Yeah. You know, in other words, Satyuga, still the weakness is they're not pure devotees.
Yeah.
They're very pious. They're as pious as you get. But it's still pure devotion, another thing. Right? So that's the whole thing. This is why this is such a difficult subject, because we think in black and white.
Yes.
You know, it's either sinful or it's pious. Right? And pious means Krishna consciousness. But the problem is because we reject the impiety, and we accept Krishna conscious sadhana, but then in the middle as a lifestyle, if we don't accept the pious lifestyle, what do we have? So we don't see that, then what's going to happen? We're going to gravitate back to the impious lifestyle. Okay, remove the four regulative four regulative principles. But it ends up as exactly the same lifestyle, the impious lifestyle. Because the basis of it is not Krishna. See, the mode of goodness lifestyle, the basis of it is Krishna's laws.
Yes.
Devotion means the basis of it is Krishna, the person.
Yes.
Okay? So these three levels, because we're used to working with two. Good, bad. You know, white, black. Warm, cold. You know, tasty, disgusting. Right? You know, it's right? Just like, you know, any teenager, you know, give them something to eat. What is it? It's either fabulous or disgusting. There's nothing in between. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So, in the discussion, so what stops us from seeing that is our identification?
Basically, it's lack of training. See, it's like this. We're not used to this, being able to look at many things at one time, right? Because for us, we're dealing with varnashram, but understanding that it's simply the external element. But that you're doing it to please Krishna, that's sad-dharma. In other words, dharma that's eternal, that's what you're using. Right? So even you're working with conditioned nature, you're working on the eternal platform, because the soul is engaging in Krishna's service. So sad-dharma works either way, either, you know, on the spiritual world or in the material world. That's why it's sad. So the difficulty comes is that we can't put the two together at once. You know? And so, therefore, the smarter can appreciate the material dharma, they can't understand the eternal, the actual spiritual dharma. Because they think it's already nitya, right? What I'm doing is already nitya. And then the person who's not from that kind of background, then for them, they also don't know what piety is. So they can relate to spiritual, but not to pious. You know what I'm saying? So that becomes the difficulty, is they're not used to it. You know, it's karma or jnana.
Yes.
Though this bhakti is third condition, so all three can work at once. Because we take it's either karma or it's jnana. We don't try to mix them. So then putting in bhakti, then it's got to be bhakti and there's no karma and jnana. But the point is bhakti already includes karma and jnana, so it's the one that synthesizes the whole thing. But we still try to fight with this karma and jnana. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's yeah.
So what to do if a person is attracted to bhakti and to the spiritual and to Krishna, but is not attracted to piety?
It's just a matter of engaging them, chanting, taking prasad, and with time it'll come. So the point is whatever position they're in, they remain in that position. And they add chanting and association with devotees, you know, with time taking prasad. I mean, of course they'll take prasad at the temple, but at home they can kind of arrange these things. You know, that kind of thing. Or at least appreciating that what they are getting to eat is by the Lord's grace. So most kind of accept that.
Well, even amongst the devotees, I know many devotees, maybe myself included, I feel very attracted to Krishna and to the spiritual practice of bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
But from the background, from where we're coming from, the whole concept of mundane piety and is not very appealing.
On one side, but on the other side, that it gives you money, and you have facility, and slick clothes, cars, this and that, that's based on piety. The only reason anybody has it is because they did it before. But because of the Western background, we don't make the connection of karma. You know, Indians do. Probably most third world could relate to it. You know, because there's always that, starts with an S. You know, you kind of think that there's something subtle happening behind. Superstitious.
Yes.
Yeah. So then, you know, then they can kind of relate that, okay, karma's there, and, you know, it works. You know, Westerners relate because it's like business. You do the thing, you get the result. But the point is you actually have to have faith that that's why it works. The guy has money, it's because of previous karma. You use it properly, it continues. You don't use it, it disappears. So artha only comes from dharma. But when you've done artha, dharma for a long time, artha starts coming, then people tend to give up dharma. As the Prabhupada mentions, like he gives the example of America. It's based on, you know, God we trust and religious principles, all that. So now it starts to become prosperous. Then people drop the religion. Before there were so many churches, he says, now so many of them are empty.
Demons are impious, but at the same time,
they're impious in mentality, but
they're very productive.
But in their real demons actually are more pious. I mean, it's just like you go talk to that superficial businessman that everybody thinks is, you know, not nice, but he'll deal with you more nicely than anybody will. It may not be very personal, but he'll always deal with anybody he meets nicely, because he knows if you don't, it can you don't know who the guy is. The guy could be, you know, unassuming and get you later. You know, so you deal nice. And plus, if I want to do something with them, if they are useful, either that, you know, as somebody, you know, to get something from or to engage, then I have to be nice. So therefore, they are able to control their senses and always be nice. We'll call it superficial, but they're following the etiquette. And while the other person down home who doesn't, is, you know, not, you know, superficial, much of the time he's a rat bag. You know, I'm an honest, you know, as if being an honest rat bag is better than being a superficial gentleman. You know, it's like, you know, how does that work?
So does following the law in the first example make that person pious, or does it just mean he knows how the energy works?
He knows how the energy works. But that's called piety. Because piety means you're getting the result. Piety means you act according to nature. That's the thing. We take it that unless it's religious, it's not pious. Hmm. Religious meaning that it's some ritual.
Yeah.
Like that.
God is involved.
It's just like this. Let us say, okay, would we say that it is an underlying, unchangeable nature of the economic field that if you're going to make profit, you have to sell something cheaper, more than what you bought it for? That's religion. You break that, you will never make profit. You know, there's a nice guy, he buys it, but then the guy, you know, he really needs, he doesn't have any money, he gives it to him for less.
One doesn't have to see the element of God in it. Even just accepting that this is the law and this is how it works, that's enough.
That's enough to make the material work. It's not enough to get you back to God.
You can be a pious atheist.
Of course.
And there's plenty.
That is Hiranyakashipu, the best example. You know? I mean, who had more than him? Even Ravana didn't have what he had. But Ravana still had more than what the demigods had. Like that. You know, I mean, he at one point he took them all and tied them up and put them where he wanted, so that, you know, when his son was born, then it would work nicely, you know, like that. You know, I want this chart for my son, so it's not the time, so he just took the planets and put them where he wanted, like that. You know, so, you know, Indra can't do that. So these are amazing, but that piety came because of their connection to the Lord. But the point is that's the difficulty. We take piety, religion, you know, the ritual, and spiritual as all the same thing. So that's why then the Bhagavatam, especially Gita does it, but Bhagavatam especially dissects all this so we can see the difference. And then we complain, it's so technical. But the point is if you don't, then we don't actually understand what we're dealing with. You know, therefore, devotees will take morality as the top, as the serious platform of religion, but not cleanliness, for example.
Can I go to the three again as well? As spiritual, ritual,
and impiety. You know, and then the karma, yeah. But, so in other words, spiritual is the real piety. And material impiety is actually impiety. But within that impiety, there's better piety. There's what you call, just like in a prison. You have bad criminals and you have what you call good criminals. The one that follows all the laws of the prison and does nicely, the warden's happy, they're called good criminals. So that's in the material world what we call a pious man. He's a good criminal. Right? So he's willing to follow the laws of the state. Well, the bad one doesn't want to follow the laws. So we're thinking that by our intellectual prowess that I don't have to follow. So that's really foolish. That's Mayaya Apritigyana. Is they think that by my intelligence I can do whatever I like. So that means their intelligence has been stolen by Maya. Because there's laws. It doesn't work like that. Just because you feel. So therefore, all it is they're big kids. Right? Take people that sit in a building, in a room, all day and never interact really with the outside world. And if they do, they're totally dysfunctional. And then they're going to raise the next generation. Right? So they're just very intelligent kids. Right? A kid is socially dysfunctional. Because he's cute, he gets by. Right? Professors aren't cute. So when they go out and they're socially dysfunctional, it doesn't work out for them. And then these guys are going to say how the universe works. They're going to say however you feel, that's how it's going to do. You know, power of attraction, I want it. The whole universe is just there serving me and bringing everything to me. No, you want it, therefore Krishna sanctions it. Then material nature does it. So who's the law of attraction? Who's got the attraction? Paramatma. He's attracting it on your behalf. But you have to desire it. This whole thing is, no, I'm the one attracting. He said, therefore, so you're dealing with a very important element of Vedanta, but at the same time, soaked in false ego, like, you know, like a baklava or a, you know, a rasgulla. You know, it's just totally, you know, permeated with false ego. You know? And the worst part is not as good as the baklava or the rasgulla. Right? Makes sense. Professor with false ego, rasgulla. Take the rasgulla. You get more out of it.
Okay. Yeah.
So, okay. Adhyaya Prakashika. The 16th chapter describes the victory tour of Parikit. So it's kind of like the first canto. It's very... Well, no, actually, it'll be... Actually, the all nine cantos are dealing with what the first six chapters of Gita dealt with, but now on a more technical level.
Okay.
Right? Okay, yeah. The 16th chapter describes the victory tour of Parikit. The question by Dharma to the earth and earth's lamentation about her separation from Krishna. Sutta Goswami explains that once, as Maharaj Parikit was reigning under the guidance of the Brahmanas, he punished the master of Kali Yuga, who was causing pain to a cow and a bull. Sri Shanaka Rishi inquires about the punishment of Kali and explains the glories of hearing about topics related to Krishna. Sutta relates that after Maharaj Parikit perceives the influence of the age of Kali within his kingdom, he initiates a tour to defeat Kali. He just sees symptoms are there, so that means Kali must be around. So he goes to look for it. While touring Mars, Prickett hears the glories of his great relatives, the Pandavas. Dharma, who is wandering in the form of a bull, questions the earth in the form of a cow about the cause of the earth's current miserable condition. The earth implies that her misery is caused by her separation from Krishna's presence, by the increase of Kali's influence due to Krishna's absence. Maharaj Parikshit then arrives. So here it says that he was successful, right? He arrived.
Right? He also was planning.
Huh? He was planning.
Because he was looking.
He was looking, yeah. So interesting here, misery, separation from Krishna and due to Kali's influence, right? So the point is this, the main thing is separation from Krishna. The secondary is because of Kali's influence, then things don't go so smoothly, so it becomes a distraction in connection with Krishna. Mm-hmm. Right? So those kind of elements. Shloka Anusharam, summary of verses. Verses 1 to 9, Shonaka Rishi inquires about the punishment of Kali. Verses 10 to 24, Maharaj Pariket tours his kingdom and Dharma questions the earth. Verses 25 to 36, the earth's reply. Verses 1 to 9, Shonaka Rishi inquires about the punishment of Kali. In this section, Suta Goswami explains how Maharaj Pariket punished the master of Kali Yuga, who was causing pain to a cow and a bull. Shonaka Rishi inquires about the punishment of Kali and explains the glories of hearing about topics to Krishna. Suta Goswami said, after the Pandavas retired from this material life, Maharaj Pariket assumed the royal position of emperor of the world under the instruction of the Brahmanas. He ruled by those great qualities which were foretold by expert astrologers at the time of his birth. So he ruled by those great qualities. It doesn't say he ruled by his great skill.
Yes.
Right? In other words, skill is what you apply the qualities through. So you're ruling by qualities.
Yes.
Right? Does that make sense? Like, let's say you want to do something, you have a machine, the machine works by electricity. So you're getting the job done by electricity. Right? But it's going through the medium of that machine.
Mm.
Right? So you can say, no, but the skill is enough. Will the machine work without the electricity?
No.
That's the whole point. So the skill without the proper character doesn't work. You know what I'm saying? This is just, let's say, talking about something where there's not so much character. Right? I remember hearing one, he was, you could say he was one of the top Veena players in South India. And he was also probably, you could say, the top teacher in South India in music. So he was talking about another person who was even better than him. And he was talking to a third musician, you know, who was also, you know, quite good, not as good as him, but like an associate. And so they were talking about this one, and they talked about what attitude the guy had, the top guy, you know, the musician. And then the person we're talking about, he was a professor. And so he said, yes, but his music is so good, it's natural he'll have that kind of ego. So, you know, it's because he's that good, therefore, out of etiquette, you have to tolerate that ego. You know, he was just making the point, kind of from a positive point of view. Of course, he's going to have that ego. He's the best. But that ego can only be there when he's off stage. You know? The stage is not right. The mic's not right. This is not right. That's not right. He doesn't like the lighting. He doesn't like the this. He doesn't like that. But as soon as he starts playing, if that ego is there, then no one's going to listen. Right? If that ego's there when they're playing, that's called a prima donna. Right? And no one really has a good opinion about the prima donna. Like that. They all have to work because they got the top part, but otherwise it's... You understand? So in other words, here we're taking a grosser example. So the thing is that the character, but when you're applying it, if that false ego is there, it will never work. It can't, because false ego means ignorance, which means the past, means you won't function in the present. You know, this stage is not as good as the other one that I was at. So you're thinking of the past, so how you'll function in the present. Right? Yes.
So in training of character, the age seems to be very important element.
Yes.
Because training adults, it's... Like, you know, we hear Bhagavatam, we come, and then when we gone, it's like all the same.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Ages, that's why the beginning of life is student life. It means the very beginning is meant for being with the family and getting all that, I would say, attention and emotional input, so that the principle of relationship and interaction is developed. Then once that's developed as a basis, because the whole point is developing a relationship with the Lord and with the devotees. So that will come. It's coming because of attachment as opposed to purely a spiritual consideration, but it is an important principle. It's a foundational principle. But it's only good up to five. After five, then it starts to degrade. Right? So then it means up to five, it's about other people. After five, as it continues, then it starts to become about themselves. So it's not recommended like that. Then, then you have to have training. Then it has to continue. It's about others. Because after five, it starts to become about yourself. Because you get comfortable with it and start to think, okay, I'm okay. Everyone likes me. I'm cute. Like, you know, it's one of the things when smaller kids come to the school, a lot of times you have the difficulty, even sometimes bigger. If they're actually more cute, they know how to behave like that, they try to use it to their advantage. Because at home, they're doing something wrong or did something wrong, they just turn on the cute, you know, energy, and then everything kind of works out. But here they turn on the cute energy and it's kind of like, you know, you still got to wash the bucket. You know, it just doesn't work. So at that point, then they either figure out, okay, you know, let's do this, or that's when they go home. You know, so that's what the first 3 weeks is about. The first 3 weeks is about, can they handle actually not being the center of attention, that they're part of a bigger, a community. And if they can do it, then they make it to that. So that's the whole point, is that education means you learn when you're young, because you don't have great attachments. You have some, but not much. You know, how much attachments do you gain by your five, you know? You know, it's more about how people deal with you and getting something that you want to eat or not being in a situation you don't want to be. But other than that, material facilities, they don't really care.
Right.
You know, I mean, the little girls, of course, they want to wear this outfit, not that. But the boys, it's like, you, whatever you put them in, they just really don't care, you know. So that early time, that's when they do. And the younger is how you say, basically you can say up to 12, is that means, how you say, pre-hormones, then it's memorization and fundaments, like that. Once the hormones hit until they become adult, then it's technical. If it's not technical and it's not practical, they're not interested. Mm-hmm. And then when they hit adult, then they can start to appreciate the subtleties, the philosophy. So adults appreciate the philosophy, but without those other two background elements, mm-hmm. then they have a tendency to not be able to see how the philosophy applies technically or personally or all these different things. So it's a nice program. But even if you don't have it because of intelligence, because it's Buddhi yoga, you can apply it. It just may not be as quick. Yes. Like the children can apply it quicker. The realization takes longer.
Yes.
The adult, it'll be quick to apply, but they could get, I mean, how you say, sometimes slow to apply, but if they do, then the realization gets maturity. At the same time, because of that, generally it comes quicker in the kids because they will apply it. And it comes slower in adults because they won't. So, does that make sense? But the point is an adult can do it by determination. They know it's good, they committed to it, they keep applying it, then it will work for them. Because that's the point. Bhakti is universal. There's the ideal, and then there's the reality. Like that. So it still works. You know, it's just maybe you won't memorize as many Gita shlokas as the kids can. You know, like that. You could probably say this. We could probably forget as many verses as they learn. You know, that we could be expert at, yes. You know, well, you've learned hundreds, I've forgotten thousands. Yeah, so, you know. Like that, so you know, everybody has their area of, you know, outstandingness. Yes.
But Maharaj, can we say that after a certain age, like 50, 60, we are?
Yeah, don't worry about memory, though.
No. But there is it's a very nice opportunity to study and
yes,
to,
it's natural.
Yes, natural.
That's the point of Vanaprastha. Is that then one can study again, because all the time spent for all the little details within family life now is free for studying and associating and sadhana. It's still, you know, basic things are there, but the general, it's free from that. Grihastha should be able to study if they have a background of that. So if it means the Vedic Academy, study was nice, so therefore as a Grihastha you continue studying. The modern academy, it's study means cramming, and cramming hurts. So therefore, once one gets out of that, not that many like to do it again. A couple do, but it's really a small handful. Most people, it's like they don't want to look at a book again for a long time. The next time they look at a book is when they have to read to their kids. Right? that's a, you know, fun. So it's, but it is a good opportunity. But same time, Krishna consciousness, any time is a good time. But we find that Brahma, that student life and the retired life, these two ends are, you have the maximum amount of time to apply it and less distraction.
Yes.
So can one say that the building of character means understanding Dharma, your Dharma? And
yes, Dharma. Yes. Because the point is it's, you could even say, it's the Dharma of relationship is the main thing. So that's what we're saying. The small kids, that's the first thing to learn, is relationships. So it's really sad when you see parents who won't correct their children, you know, small kids, when they're behaving badly. Because they, oh, they're kids, it doesn't matter. But then they develop the thing is, I can do whatever I want. Rather than, no, there's things that you have to do. In other words, it's about relationships, so it's about doing right. Why does a baby cry? Because you're doing something wrong. So why shouldn't it go the other way? If they're doing something wrong, why shouldn't someone else get upset? It's really logical and just, and any kid can understand it. And then they have a foundation. Then you can build on that. You know, it's like what Prabhupada said, I think it's the introduction to Gita, that the foundation in spiritual life that his father gave them, then that was furthered by when he met his spiritual master. So that's the point, it has to be a well-rounded foundation. In other words, they're taken care of, so physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and socially, all these things are developed. But it's simple, it's just the fundaments. But when the fundaments aren't there, it's kind of, later on, then you have a problem. Like that. So Okay, so then Srila Prabhupada writes in his commentary, at the time of Maharaj Parikrit's birth, the expert astrologer Brahmanas foretold some of his qualities. Maharaj Parikrit developed all those qualities, being a great devotee of the Lord. The real qualifications become a devotee of the Lord. Then gradually all the good qualities worthy of possession developed. So that's the point, is that bhakti will get you those qualities. That's the real way you're going to get it. So, in other words, they foretold it, but he got them by devotion. Because otherwise you may have, on the material platform, it's very, very slow and takes very long to gain. But in this way, then very quickly you can get it.
Mark?
Yes?
Does it mean that astrology talks about potential of a person, or that's what's going to happen?
It talks about the field. And the thing is when you're dealing with materialists, then it pretty much as it's there is how it's going to happen. But with devotees, it's basically what's the general kind of situation. But how it will work, the timing of it, doesn't necessarily mean it will work according to the astrology. So when devotees get so much into astrology, it's not actually so worthwhile, because it changes for devotees. It means not that those areas aren't going to be what's going to work, but there's going to be, by the Lord's influence, things will happen possibly a little differently. Sometimes they happen in that. It means, in other words, if that's the good time for something to happen, then it will happen that way. But if it's not the good time, it won't happen. Like that. So it's simply the astrology tells you what the field is. It doesn't tell you really what you'll do with it. Of course, they'll say, yes, we can tell everything, but that's not the reality. They can tell inclination, but the point is the soul, his independence, you can't tell. Materials will always work according to the chart because they're under the modes. But the devotee has the choice to be under the modes or not. So if he functions not under the modes, then it's not going to work according to the chart. Right? It's going to work according to how Krishna wants it to work, which may be exactly according to the chart. Right? So the point is the chart simply tells you what your conditioning is and the situations of that conditioning. So now it's a matter of how you use those in Krishna's service. So that's the only importance of it. But it's not for us, it's not a major position. So we see here at the time of birth, you don't hear about it regularly discussing. It's not a major issue. Just the time of birth, then you get the idea of, okay, what kind of soul is this? Then you can see, okay, then these things will go. So you know where the strengths will be, weaknesses will be. You know, they have good health or they don't have such good health. So, in other words, if they don't have such good health, if there's a situation that could be a little bit delicate, then you take more care. But if they have good health, then if the thing's delicate, you know, but the facility's not so, you don't need to make more of an endeavor because it'll work. You know, those kind of things. That's all it's for. So you know what you work. It's like you say, before you buy something, you know, you read up about it and what it does and its qualifications and everything, and then you get it. But it's not that you keep reading those when you're using it, you know. It's like you're driving down the road in your car and then you get out the review of it and keep reading it and, you know. Then, you know. Is that, you know, yeah. Okay. Such great kings were more responsible than modern elected executive heads because they obliged the great authorities by following their instructions left in Vedic literatures. Because right? They do better because the same principle. They're following the laws of nature as instructed by the authorities who know this. Therefore, they're more responsible. The modernists, it's more about staying in office.
Yes.
It's not about not staying in office. Of course, you have occasionally the person who wants to do the right thing and this and that, but how long do they last? You know, so that the whole thing is just, they're not as responsible because they're not working under these authorities, right, that are following, you know, the, according to the laws. There was no need for impractical fools to enact daily a new legislative bill and to conveniently alter it again and again to serve some purpose. Right? And there was the point of bureaucracy yesterday. The rules and regulations were already set forth by great sages like Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parasara, and other liberated sages. And the enactments were all suitable for all ages in all times. Right? So the point is it's universal. This idea to try to limit the Vedic, that it's just another time and place, and so it's not this time and place, that's Prabhupada's putting that to the side. Vedic always applies. The principle always applies. Detail, of course, you have to change, because even in the Vedic era, you have to apply it according to time, place, and circumstance. What's the whole point of Arjuna and Ashwatthama? And then you have Bhima and Krishna on one side and Yudhishthira and Draupadi on the other with two different opposing opinions. Now, he's having to apply all those Vedic rules according to the particular situation. That's the point to learn. But it's to be done so that he pleases Krishna and the Vaishnavas. Right? So in other words, since we're faced every day with trying to do the impossible, might as well try to do the impossible for Krishna. Right, since it's already impossible, throw in Krishna. That's also impossible. So, but you know, we're getting it done. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. No? Yes. The rules and regulations were already set forth by great sages like... Oh, you mismentioned that. Yeah, so Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parasara, these are the three Dharma Shastras we use. And other liberated sages. And the enactments were all suitable for all ages and all places. So right there, this whole point, oh, Manu's for different, it's not for now. Prabhupada just said, no. It's for all ages in all places. So all ages means Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. And all places means anywhere on the planet. Yes.
What are, from Manu we have Manu Sanghita, excuse me, and from Yajnavalkya and Parashara, what are their books, everything that they've written, or just specific?
No, it's just the Manu Shastra. I mean the Dharma Shastra. There's a Parashara Dharma Shastra, there's a Yajnavalkya one. They're short. Because Parasara is specifically giving how to apply Manu in Kali Yuga, you know, in areas that aren't so obvious, right? Most of them, it's, they apply any time, like be nice to people, you know, that one you don't have to get into a Kali Yuga equivalent, you know. So, but certain what rules then that are have may not be as widely understood, then he gives some more detail like that. Yajnavalkya, I'm not exactly sure.
So when you study or teach Manu, you do the whole work or you just focus on certain elements? Because if you read Manu, it seems like 90-95% one may say, you know, okay, how does this...
No, there's about one quarter that's not so important for those age. One quarter of them.
Is not so important.
Yeah. You're talking about around 2,000 verses, so about, you know, 500. They're specific. You know, like it says, Ni Yoga you don't use in this age. Ni Yoga is the brother begetting children on his brother's wife. You know, so that's not used. The, how you say, animal sacrifices for the Pitri Puja, you know, Shraddha, that's not used. Then, you know, cow sacrifices, horse sacrifices, you know, the principle of sannyasa that's not connected with devotion. So these are the aspects that you don't use. But otherwise, everything else applies. You know. Means, you know, the same night. It's about, you know, out of 400 pages, maybe 100 pages are ones that the principle of it's still valuable, but the detail is not.
And there's a lot of forms of punishment which involve death, which is not by the legal code of most of the countries.
That's up to the individual. Like in America, even every state can make their own law. When they say it's universal, it's not universal.
But often there is also other alternatives given, besides capital punishment, that there is other
things. It depends upon
that
who it is.
Yeah.
Depends on who it is. Brahmins, it's never capital punishment.
Yeah.
But as it goes down, then generally it would apply.
It becomes more heavy.
Yeah, like that. In some cases. In some cases, it's the other way around. Brahmins, it'll never be capital punishment or corporal punishment, but you may have the fines are greater.
But then again, capital punishment, but if it's not permissible according to the law of the country...
But the point is that's not the deal-breaker with Manu. Because most of it, because the areas that deal with that much, you generally get them in one chapter out of 12. So these other 11 chapters are quite viable. Because
yeah.
They talk about character. And yeah. The first six chapters are philosophy... And ashram dharma, right? Then the next chapter is just what a king's daily life is about. What are the important elements? Then after that, you get into civil law and domestic law. So those also run pretty straightforward. The principle, criminal law, the principle of what's heavier and what's not, that still remains. Now, how you want to deal with it, that's another thing. You know, so that's not so much what it's about. It's about what is heavy and what's not.
And which commentaries would you use on Manu?
You'd use whatever it means. The traditional ones are generally the ones used. There's a few contemporary scholars that work well. You know, Penguin might not be the one you'd be after. You know what I'm saying? If you already know it, then you can use Penguin. But to learn it, then Penguin wouldn't be the one. Because that's just somebody put it nicely together in prose, kind of like out of verses, so it reads really well, but they don't necessarily always catch what the points are.
Well, mostly it's just translation of the shlokas. There isn't really a purport or an explanation to how to apply.
No, but the previous personalities have given. You can get, I think it's like a 7-volume work of it that gives all the Medititi and everybody else who's ever come.
Major commentaries.
Yeah. Like that, but you still have to be able to understand it in relationship to the Bhagavatam. Like that, because the point is the original translation is not necessarily ideal. It's in general things it works nicely, but anything that may come in conflict with Christian views, they generally translate it using not very nice synonyms. That's or anything philosophical they can't catch at all. So you kind of have to get from the wording what it is and from the commentaries. Like that. So it's very, it's weak like that. And if it's done by Indian scholars, then you won't have so much their problem. Then the philosophical will be impersonal. So you kind of have to balance between them. But it's doable. Okay. Therefore, the rules and regulations were standard and without flaw or defect. So they're just standard. They always apply. That's what Prabhupada mentions in the Gita in the third chapter about the leaders of the society should study manu, like that. Like that. So if you want to introduce something, you have to give a synopsis of the major principles, like what Narad Muni does in Seventh Canto. But if someone's into a serious study, then you study the whole work. Okay. So we've done it. I mean, with this group here, we went through the whole manu. Like that. You know, fairly quickly, but I don't know, over how many months?
4 months.
4 months, like that. Mm-hmm. So it's doable. But if you have a short time, then you'd want to just target certain verses and deal with that. Okay. Kings like Mars Prickett had their council of advisors, and all the members of that council were either great sages or Brahmins of the first order. They did not accept any salary, nor had they any necessity for such salaries. So they didn't accept, they didn't need, they were independent, like that. So we understand, so the top is this brahminical level, not ministers. Ministers are part of the bureaucracy. You know, we're not talking about the ministers, meaning the council. We're talking about the ones that they engage managerially or administratively. Right? Because those need salaries, so that's a different group. So if you're bringing up a ministry and immediately it comes up as about his salary, then we're not talking about this group. You know what I'm saying? It should be more on this and that. Then if they want to help, because then he won't be able to take care. That's another thing. But it's not about, it's a job. Because job, bureaucrats have jobs. Leaders, it's not a job. You understand? A bureaucrat, it's a job. He works in the ministry. The king, it's not a job, right? It's his duties, right? Because that's, he has to do that. The bureaucrat could work for him, could also work for a corporation. But, the state would get the best advice without expenditure. They were themselves samadarshi, equal to everyone, both man and animal. They were all self-realized souls, and they knew perfectly well how all living beings in the state would be happy, both in this life and in the next. So you have to consider all that. You can't do something in this life that will jeopardize next. You can't just deal with next that will jeopardize this life. You have to find that balance. Right? What will be progressive? They were not concerned with the hedonistic philosophy to eat, drink, be merry, and enjoy. Notice that, I say, in general, it's what's left off is, well, you know, because tomorrow you might be dead. That part's definitely left off. They were philosophers in the real sense, and they knew well what is the mission of human life. Under all these obligations, the advisory council of the king would give correct directions, and the king, or executive head, being himself a qualified devotee of the Lord, would scrutinizingly follow them for the welfare of the state. So it wasn't that he was just told what to do. So this idea of having a committee, and then they tell the president what to do. No, they give the advice, and then he scrutinizes it because he's trained, and then he sees the validity, or where he sees it's not, he asks questions until he gets valid or applicable answers. Then he himself puts it together and applies it. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is we either work on, there's one guy sitting on the top, he tells everyone what to do, and it's not discussions, or you make a committee on the top, and they tell everyone what to do without discussion. What's the difference? Whether there's one man or many, it's the same thing. You have to change it by the top is giving advice but not controlling it. Who's in the second rung, they're the ones controlling it, but they have to work under advice. Right? Otherwise, when they try to work without advice, then Parasaram kind of, you know, in a, how you say, an obvious way made it clear that that's not going to work. Right? So the state in the days of Maharaj Yudhishthira, Maharaj Parikshit, was a welfare state in the real sense of the term, because no one was unhappy in that state, be he man or animal. Parikshit was an ideal king for the welfare state of the world. But this welfare state doesn't mean that no one works. The difficulty is conservatives are worried about a welfare state because then the unscrupulous would take advantage of it and not work. And then those who actually are dutiful are going to work hard, and then they're going to be the ones taxed. So then they have to pay for all these guys that aren't working. Valid point. Right? So it's a strong point. But at the same time, there are people who need to be taken care of by the state. Right? So the point is it's the duty of the government to discern between these groups of people. Not just it's automatic. So this it's very stringent. So if you actually are in that position, then you're taken care of. Right? If not, then you work. You know, it's just so there's a balance there. So in other words, it takes care of what the liberals are looking for, you know, within its actual context, and it takes care of what the conservatives are worried about in its, you know, in its properly applicable thing. In other words, you have to be nice. Well, the interesting thing is the people who are the conservatives are worried about, they don't want a welfare state, are generally the ones that give the most charity. You know, they give huge charity. But, you know, it's to where they think it will be useful. Right? Yeah. So everybody is benefited. Everybody is satisfied. So you have to take care of everybody. Because also, welfare, it goes beyond. Because you can say, okay, but the government is protecting everybody. That's also welfare. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So that they have armies, they have police, they have, you know, civil laws. Criminal laws, domestic laws, these things, these all create ideal state. You have to have it all. The young emperor took Iravati, the daughter of King Uttara, who was the son of Urat, as his wife. Footnote 1. Srila Prabhupada notes that although Iravati was Parikshit's cousin's sister, the marriage was allowed because she was not of the same Gotra family. In the Vedic system of marriage, the importance of Gotra, her family, was stressed. Arjuna also married Subhadra, although she was his maternal cousin's sister. Because there's certain, it means, in other words, the maternal cousin, generally, and here, it's, yeah, cousin's sister, then it has to be, there's only certain conditions that it applies. It's not in general. So if you don't know the specific condition, better you follow first cousins don't get married. If you know the specific rules of it, then they can. Does that make sense?
So maternal cousin was allowed, but paternal cousin was out of the question?
From what I understand, it's not. But there may be some rules there. I've heard of in the maternal. Most don't follow it. Like in South, they have a thing like that. So it's like maternal cousins. When they're born, then it's actually arranged that they will get married. Only if when they grow up they don't want to get married, then they'll be dropped. But if they're agreeable, then it's just automatic they get married. Because it works. Because in the thing it comes out, you get the compatibility of the grandparents. Because the grandmother goes, the son goes back the other way. It goes this way. And so then it works out that they actually have the same natures as the grandparents. Like that. You know, the parents will have the opposite, same qualities but the opposite. What's in the husband, you know, and the wife will be opposite, you know. But then this will be like the grandparents, so it works out quite well.
And there are many gotras.
Yes, there's 21. It means a prajapati is the head of a gotra. So if you're in Gotama gotra, that means the head of that is starts with Gotama as the prajapati. Mm-hmm. So when you say Gotra, it means you know your family line back to the 21 Prajapatis. So that means you have to be cultured. Yes. And at the same time, it's because you have to check, that's the Gotra, Sagotra. You also have to check, what's it called? Sajati, I think, is that there's no, that even outside of that, there's no common ancestor in seven generations. In six. So the seven, you have to know to the seven so that you can see that there's no common back to there. Like that. You know, so like that. Then there's
no common in
you don't have someone, how do you say? In other words, the bloodlines won't be the same. It means you're going to have the gotra, but then you're going to have, because people marry in there, it's like maybe it's there. You're in a different gotra, but at the same time as, let's say, you know, your parents, you know, the mother or father was from that other gotra. And so then you have a common ancestor. So the bloodline, even though it's a different gotra, you're still what's called svajati. So that's what I'm saying. It's quite complicated, the thing. So either you just do the generals, you just stay away from the cousins, or you have this, because then this, it even takes it farther out, more cousins. Because seven generations, it means there's already one cousin, that's cousin. Right? First cousin. Then grandparents, that's two generations, that's the third generation, so that makes the second cousin. Right? So you can have to take it back, even within the sixth cousin you're not supposed to marry, according to the Vedic. But if you know the science, then there may be cousins within that you could marry. So, the young, Iravati gave birth to four sons, headed by Janamejaya. Footnote 2. Janamejaya, one of the Rajarshi kings and famous son of Maharaj Prickett. His mother's name was Iravati, or according to some, Madravati. Maharaj Janamejaya begot two sons of the name Yatanika and Sankukarna. He celebrated several sacrifices in the Kurukshetra pilgrimage site. And he had three younger brothers named Shrutasena, Ugrasena, and Bhimasena. Two. Bhimasena the second. Okay. He invaded Takshashila, Anjana, and he decided to avenge the unlawful curse upon his father, Maharaj Prickett. He performed a great sacrifice called Sarpa Yajna to kill the race of serpents, including the Takshaka, which had bitten his father to death. On request from it, so it seems the Takshaka is a position. Mm-hmm. On request from many influential demigods and sages, he had to change his decision to kill the race of snakes. But despite stopping the sacrifice, he satisfied everyone concerned in the sacrifice by rewarding them properly. So he had started the sacrifice, it was running, but then it got stopped at the end. That was the request by a Brahmin boy who happened to be in the snake dynasty. And so then, it says here, the saints and sages, then they approved it. And so then it was stopped at that point. In the ceremony, Mahamuni Vyasadeva was also present, and he personally narrated the history of the Battle of Kurukshetra before the king. Later on, by the order of Vyasadeva, his disciple Vaishampayana narrated before the king the subject matter of Mahabharata. He was very much affected by his great father's untimely death, was very anxious to see him again, and he expressed his desire before the great sage, Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva also fulfilled his desire. His father was present before him, and he worshipped both his father and Vyasadeva with great respect and pomp. Being fully satisfied, he most munificently gave charities to the Brahmins present at the sacrifice. Srimad Bhagavatam 116.2 purport. So this is something that seems to be unique that happened in this cycle, is that he brought. It's just like you see, is that the Rajasuya sacrifice was performed because Pandu had asked Narad Muni to convey the message to Yudhishthira that it should be done. So when Narad Muni was visiting Yamaraj, Pandu approached him and then asked to give this message to Yudhishthira. So a similar kind of thing is there. In this one we see is that he was brought. Because he'll be there in Petri Loka, so he's bought from Petri Loka. Okay. Under the direction of a spiritual master, Kripacharya, Maharaj Parikit performed three horse sacrifices on the bank of the Ganges. And at that time, even the common people were able to see the demigods that attended. Although celestial beings were not visible to the naked eyes of the inhabitants of the earth, it was due to the influence of Maharaj Parikit that the demigods agreed to be visible. In other words, it was such a nice ceremony. Everything was being very nice. So to give glory to Parikit Maharaj, and how well he was conducting, how well he was taking care and worshiping, then they agreed to be visible. So then the people are going to talk about that, you know, because the only reason they're visible is because of Pariksit Maharaj. Otherwise, they're not won't be visible. Once, when Maharaj Pariksit was on his way to conquer the world, he saw the master of Kali Yuga, who was lower than a Shudra, disguised as a king and hurting the legs of a cow and bull, because kings are supposed to protect cows and bulls. So this is, he's disguised as. The king at once caught hold of him to administer sufficient punishment. 2-4. In his purport to verse 4, Srila Prabhupada explains that the purpose of a king's going out to conquer the world is not for self-aggrandizement. Maharaj Pariksit went out to conquer the world after his ascendance to the throne, but this was not for the purpose of aggression on the other states. He was the emperor of the world, and all small states were already under his regime. His purpose in going out was to see how things were going on in terms of the godly state. Right, so if the kingdom was going nice, if it's going well, then there's nothing to be said. If it's not, it has to be corrected. If the king's willing to correct it, fine. If not, then there's war. Right? So it's not about expanding the kingdom, especially with him. He's already the emperor. It's a matter of sort of that the whole empire is working on godly principles. The king, being the representative of the Lord, was to execute the will of the Lord duly. So he's the representative of the Lord, but he listens to higher representatives of the Lord. Right? He listens to the Brahmins and sages. So just because one's a representative of the Lord doesn't mean that one doesn't still follow the process. Right? Vyasadeva was the Lord himself, and he's still listening to Narad Muni as the representative of the Lord. There's no question of self-aggrandizement. Thus, as soon as Maharaj Pariksit saw that a lower class man in the dress of a king was hurting the legs of a cow and bull, at once he arrested and punished him. The king cannot tolerate insults to the most important animal, the cow, nor can he tolerate disrespect to the most important man, the Brahmana. Human civilization means to advance the cause of Brahminical culture and to maintain it. Cow protection is essential. So here's the point, that civilization means to advance the cause of Brahminical culture. It's not cultivating Brahminical culture. It's not actually human civilization. Like that. It's simple. Like that. So that's the whole point. If Hanuman, who is a Vanara, could be a devotee, then of course, then those who are tribals can also be devotees. But the point of that, it's just a matter of following that culture is you don't need something higher. That's wrong, right? Hanuman and the monkeys, they say we're Vanaras and we do Vanara stuff, but we're devotees. But they don't say that no one should do human stuff. They should all do Vanara stuff. Because the whole point is saying that everybody is Western, therefore they don't have to follow. You can't apply that to everybody. Every Westerner will not agree that he is the same as everybody else. Many are looking for something higher, something more developed, something more civilized. Does that make sense? So even amongst the tribals, they won't agree that I want to remain as a tribal. But the point is, in the Vedic system, a tribal wants to remain as a tribal, fine, but identify yourself as a tribal. Don't try to say, no, everybody, we can't follow human society, we can only follow tribal society. That's cheating. The whole point is Vedic accommodates both. Right. It's the Western that doesn't accommodate a tribe that's less than yours. Not the Vedic. The Vedic was tons of tribals. It's the West, as soon as they find tribals, then they either wipe them out or they, totally, control them and take everything. Yes?
If you identify this, is this considered criticism?
If I identify this?
Anyone.
Means what's your purpose in identifying it? Means we're identifying it so that the persons in this room will be educated to know what's human and what's tribal, and not get confused by fancy talk.
Okay, and then if the people in this room go out and identify in the outside of here.
But what's their purpose?
To us with the education.
Well, that's fine.
But isn't that criticism?
Criticism means, see, there's training and there's criticism. Criticism means you make a comment, but you're not about to take the responsibility to uplift. Right? Training means you're willing to do that. So in other words, you don't say it unless you can deal with it.
Yes.
So in other words, we're saying it here so that people won't be bewildered. Now, they, going out, they should only say it if they're willing to deal with it.
Can you emphasize?
Means, in other words, if someone's doing something wrong, if you're not showing them how to correct it, what's the meaning? So, in other words, criticism means that there's some social element about it. Right? What we're talking about is what's the actual philosophical or religious element about it. So it's the fundament on which, therefore, you'll base what you're doing. Because you can't do something right if you don't know what you're doing, dealing with. Like, how do you, means if you're going to cook, if you can't tell the difference between a potato and spinach, then you're going to end up with some problems, right? In other words, you take the potato, you know, and wash it, right? You don't have to peel it or anything. Right? And then you put it in the pot and just bring the, you know, just in a small amount of water. You know, just a little bit, a few millimeters on the bottom of the pot. When it comes to a boil with the lid on, that steam, within about 30 seconds to a minute, will wilt the potatoes. And then they'll be ready. You put some salt and pepper and butter, you know, whatever it is that you want to do when they're ready to eat. Right? No. You know, and then the spinach, you have to take that, you have to peel it, you have to, you know, do all that kind of stuff, put it in a pot, cut it up, put it in a pot, boil it, you know, in a full pot of water for 20 minutes. Right? So if you can't tell the difference, then either you're going to end up with a bunch of raw potatoes or spinach soup at best. Because I'm not sure how much will be left once you peel the spinach. You know, you kind of have the stalk left. That's about the only thing that will be left. So you have this pot full of spinach stalks. You understand? So the thing is, you can't tell the difference. How can you work with it? This idea is, though, just I feel it, I can work. That is totally unreasonable, especially when it's also popular about these self-help where you're trying to understand and these are so opposing to each other. We're saying, know the field, then you can work with the field.
Yes, I absolutely understand and agree. I'm just trying to understand how we can apply this in the outside world.
You apply it in your own life.
Yeah. How much is it our responsibility?
Whatever you have influence. You have influence, you do. You don't have influence, you don't.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay.
I understand. I just don't. Practically.
Yes. Practically understand. This means we're having a class here.
Okay. So don't worry.
Devotees come.
Okay.
They want to hear.
Yeah.
Those who don't want to come, don't come.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So we're not necessarily telling people that don't want to hear. Right? It may be they come and then they find out they don't want to hear. But then the choice is theirs, you know. We don't go running after them. Does that make sense?
We see those two principles, cow protection and Brahmana protection,
yes,
always mentioned in Vedas.
Yes.
Always. What's the connection? Because nowadays, you know, many people talk about cow protection, but nobody's. I never heard some people say Brahmana protection.
No, but until you hear that, you won't have community.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
yes.
As long as devotees don't, you won't have, because it's the brahmanas are the ones that lead and give direction. So that's the whole point, is that it's brahminical culture. So that means its culture is about understanding Brahman, not about just being comfortable with your body. Yeah, I am my body, so therefore I just deal with my body how I'm comfortable dealing with my body. It's about understanding I'm the soul, and therefore what is the nature of the soul, the body, the situations of the body, others' bodies, you know, how the bodies interact, all those kind of things. So that it's progressive and you move towards understanding Brahman, or transcendence. Because if it's only pious, it's still not technically Brahminical. Though they may follow the rules, but it's not actual Brahminical. That's why it says, someone knows, then that's good. Better is someone who practices. Better than practice is someone who realizes. Better than that is a devotee. So that's the one. Then the cows, because cows provide milk. And milk is what's used in sacrifice. Right? It's offered to the deities, it's used in the yagyas, it's used in the abhishek. Right? So, and by drinking milk, it develops the finer brain tissues. So it's quite important in the process. Right? And then you were talking about cow protection. People talk about cow protection, but the new fad is being a vegan. So then you seemingly say, it appears as if you care about the cows, but you couldn't care less. Have you ever heard of a vegan dairy farm?
No,
I've never heard of it. So they'll talk about, I won't drink milk, but they will never go out and take care of cows. So they're not actually caring about cows.
So it's not technically cow protection.
No, it's not. It's just something to do to keep yourself busy. Right, you need something to keep the bile moving, so you feel, you know, you're doing something, you know, like that.
And you're feeling good about it.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, it's like I was making this bed, and then I read something about the steel screws, because I need to use, like, I don't remember, 3 or 4 inch screws, big screws, and that they cover it with this special, very rare metal. So that they don't stick. You can put them in and you can take them back out, right? They don't rust and it's not just tin, it's some real special thing. But the mining of that is super, destructive to the environment.
Toxic?
Yeah, some kind of thing. I don't know what it was, but they really have to make a mess to get this little bit of stuff. So then I decided, you know, hey, we're not supporting this, so, you know, I bought brass screws, right? You know. But it's not that you care about the environment, but it's not necessarily that you yourself are going to do something, go out and grow a tree or something like that. Though we did plant one in Jerusalem, but, you know, other than that. So the thing is it's nice, it's supportive, but it's still not enough. There has to be, what's the importance of cows? Just that you don't, not that you don't exploit cows, but why are cows special that you don't want to exploit them? You know, because now it's cows. I mean, you go back some years, it was I think it was blue whale, the blue whales or killer whales, or there was some
whales.
Huh?
Yes.
Something that, yes. that was the rage that everybody was worried about. Or, you know what I'm saying? You know, it's just like everybody's talking about, you know, all the oil companies, this and that. But when there's an oil spill, how many people are down on the beach washing the ducks? There's a handful of people. So those ones can talk. They can, you know, they can talk all day and yell and scream and all that. They're the ones that are there.
Yeah.
You know, how many people are chaining themselves to a tree, you know, when they're coming to level the forest, right? Those guys can talk. You know, they do. You know what I'm saying? But everybody else is nice. They're supportive. But the whole point is now if you had vegans who are running a dairy and doing it nicely, now those guys could talk. Because the point is if you have milk from protected cows, you try to give it to a vegan, there's a good chance they won't take it. You know, because it's an identity. It's not an actual philosophy. It's an identity. You know, I'm a vegan, I'm a punk, I'm a goth, I'm a this. You know, it's just one of those things. You know, the more you add, I'm a vegan punk, I'm a vegan goth. You know, then it's you know, then you add to your credentials here. Okay. Human civilization means to advance the cause of Brahminical culture and to maintain it. And to maintain it, cow protection is essential. There is a miracle in milk, for it contains all the necessary vitamins to sustain human physiological conditions for higher physiological or psychological, no,
physiological
for higher achievements, right? They could just put an F, right? You know, so. For higher achievements, right? So that's the whole point, is it develops the finer brain tissues. That's why it's so important. So the vegan's not getting that. So then how does he develop the finer brain tissues? You know? Okay. Brahminical culture can advance only when man is educated to develop the quality of goodness. And for this, there's prime necessity of food prepared with milk, fruits, and grains. Bharas Pariksit was astonished to see that a black Shudra, dressed like a ruler, was mistreating a cow, a most important animal in human society. Right? Because the king's supposed to be human and civilized, and he's bothering a cow, which is always protected. So this was astonishing to him. So goodness is there. So that's why the rules are there, to see that one stays in goodness. Yes.
Does this element of protection include creating facilities for the cows and the Brahmins?
Yes. In other words, it's something that is there in education. So you see the educators are educating people in that. And then the king is to see that it's being maintained, the people are actually applying it. Right, because the educators can only educate, but the king has to see this actually going on. Right, then it works nicely. So that's what I think he heard. So he goes around, then he sees it's not being. He takes care of that. So that's why that combination has to work. Leadership means the combination between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, because the Brahmins know what to do. The Kshatriyas are the ones that know how to do it. Right, so those two things are there. They can't function without each other. Because Brahmins, the only way that what they're talking about gets established is if the Kshatriyas apply it. And the Kshatriyas, they can apply things, but they won't know what to apply without the direction from the Brahmins. So the two go together. Yeah. You know, it's like a car and the driver. Yeah. Right? You know,
like that. Yes. This is why they are both... supposed to go to Gurukul when they are young.
Yes, that's why they both go to Gurukul. And they grow up together, they do the same thing, so their background is the same, so they can relate to each other. But just their focus on what they focus on in that background, that will be different.
So the amount of years that people spend at the Gurukul is different depending on their varna. So they all start off initially together, the Vaishyas, the Kshatriyas, and the Brahmins.
Yes.
Shudras don't go to Gurukul.
They generally, traditionally, if you're having the full thing, they would come as day students to learn a specific topic of their area. In other words, they learn that, let's say they're musicians. So they would come to learn the Shastra on music.
Okay.
But music they learn from their music group.
But here, for instance, you take everybody and you keep everybody for a certain...
Because Prabhupada mentioned 25 is your ideal, then everybody's trained nicely.
But you can see that certain ones let them branch out whenever it's conducive for them.
Yes.
After what, 14, 15, 16
years of age? Depends on the individual.
Age, like
some
that.
People start very early, know what they want. Some people start later. Mm-hmm. Like I remember one kid, he was 16. And he was still in our just very generic, just general program. No specializations at all. No music, no nothing. And, you know, I was wondering what's going to happen with this guy. You know, then eventually he started getting a little bit and all that. And then eventually after when he got, he figured out what he's doing. And he was always, you know, president, vice president and things like that in temples. So, you know, it took him longer to figure it out. But he eventually figured it out. Like that. So some kids, you know, from very early, I had kids from 11, they were actually running classes in Vedic mantras. So that's very technical. You have to be very good. That means he already knew them by 11. So that means he was already serious from like when he was 8 or younger. So that by that time he could actually teach them. So you get both. The point is the Gurukul system accommodates that there's a general program, but then you have the element of refining it for each individual as they actually show qualification. Is that, so it's a very good system. Does it can accommodate day yes. students? It accommodates morning students. Right. So it has a very universal application. But you have to be interested in cultivating the mode of goodness and Brahminical culture to find it of value. So if the child or the parent don't value that, then it's the wrong place.
Well, the expectations, the economic expectations are just different. Like in a proper society, majority is growing stuff or doing, something like that. But nowadays in our society, there isn't that much emphasis on that. So like, how many Vaishyas do you see coming out of Gurukul?
Oh no, Vaishyas you don't have to worry about. Shudras and Vaishyas are going to happen anyway.
Yeah. But how many people do we have who are actually...
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to count the white folk there, but, if you want to count the white folk, then that's another thing. If you count what we had before, all the Bengalis, all the Indians, they're all out doing well. The original houses over on that side, those are all by our Bengali boys. Now the Westerners are taking it out. But all the original houses there, they were all by our boys. So where'd they have... And they own the house. They own the house, they own the land. And not only that, they have a house or apartment in the West that they own also. Right? That's rare you find a Westerner that actually owns a place here and owns a place in the West. Generally, if they have it here, then they sell it, then they get one in the West, and they sell that, then they get one in Vrindavan, they sell that, then they get one. Here they have both.
But the emphasis on cow protection and agriculture and actually doing something...
That's another thing. That is...
real.
Everybody talks about sustainable, but who does it?
Yeah, not talking bricks and...
No, but the point is you have to have all. You have to have the urban and the rural.
Sure.
That's the point, is that some focus only on urban and can't relate to rural, and some others on rural and can't relate to urban. So generally those who talk Varnashram only talk rural. That's why nobody else gets interested, because most people are living in the urban environment, so you have to apply it in the urban environment. Then it works. It works well. Yudhishthira lives in a city, and so it works. It's just you have to know the science better. It's not that if you're getting, if there's dirt under your fingernails from growing carrots, then you're involved in Varnashram. Then, that's not going to work. But, one of the, Varnashram, activists, that was their comment. Like that. Enough of this theory and philosophy, let's see some practical growing carrots. But you don't hear about them anymore. So that's the sad part. Is that it's the training, it's the focus is on ashram, and then the varna element comes with time. But if you don't focus on ashram, then you don't get anything of standard in varna. Means the business and the artist you'll get anyway. But the character may not be very good. But Brahmins and Kshatriyas, you won't get any quality at all without ashram training. So the two go together. If it's appreciated, it happens. Point is devotees don't appreciate it. But here, this is in first canto. So you haven't even gotten, and most devotees have kind of gone through the first canto. But we don't catch it. It's all about that. And this is not just this purport. We've already gone through so many purports. And so that's the thing. We catch that, then we support it. That's the thing. It's just like, let's say, you need to fix the electricity in the temple. You call an electrician. The electrician says, we need this, we need that. You say yes. But if we have a farm, you need a farmer. And if the farmer says, we should grow this or grow that, then the committee says no. So therefore, there are no farms. But electricity works, because we actually call an electrician.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Srila Prabhupada ki Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki Jai Nitai Gaura Premana.
Thank you.
to follow on from my previous question, I've come up against some trouble sometimes when I don't go after people to try and tell them, you know, this or that. But if some situation comes up and then there's a conversation of what the problem is, and then they say, oh, you're criticizing, but actually I'm just pointing what you're saying.
So don't bring it up, unless it's going to have an effect on changing the persons you're talking about life, then don't get involved.
Yeah, but I say, can you please not do whatever, because it affects me in some way, and they say why, and then I explain why, and then they, you know, freak out about it.
Yeah, but then you have to find better ways to tell why. There are nice ways to say why also.
That's fine. What I'm trying to get at is they're saying that I'm criticizing devotees, but it's actually not.
No, but the point is they're not under your, how you say, authority or things like that, so therefore don't worry about it.
But I'm not trying to apply any authority. I'm simply,
I know, but the point is, it's like a teacher can tell the student what they like.
Yeah.
You know, or if you're an authority, you can tell who's under you what you like, because you have to correct them, you have to guide them on that. You're just one devotee talking to another devotee. So there's no real position to instruct them. So therefore, don't instruct them.
I'm not instructing either. I'm simply explaining where I'm
coming. I know, but that's still instruction. And see, the point is if you're saying this and they think it's great and fabulous, then keep on doing it. But if you do it and they don't appreciate it, why do it?
Because they're asking me for the reason why I have approached them or why I have.
But don't approach them.
But they're not behaving correctly.
So don't worry about it. You just make adjustments. You just say, then just work on it, don't do this. And they say, why? It says, I don't like it. And if you say, I don't like it, then that's like the supreme authority. And then they won't do it. Oh, she doesn't like that. You know. But even, you know, don't get into other things.
Okay.
Just try that. And if people appreciate, then you tell. If they don't appreciate, don't tell.
But technically, it's not criticizing devotees if you.
The thing is the best is not to get involved unless someone wants to know. That's the rule on instruction. Unless they want to know, you don't instruct them.
Mm. But they do want to know because they're asking.
No, but you've already said something, therefore they're asking.
Oh, okay.
You understand? So don't say something in the first place unless they really want to know. You know, in other words, you deal with your life nicely and be, you know, humble and tolerant with others. But then it'll go along. If it doesn't bother you, just say, please don't do that, it bothers me. And if they say, why, you know, it just says, you know, it's not clean, I like things clean.
Okay.
So there's not a matter of criticism, it's just, you know, that's the way it is. You know what I'm saying? So you have to find in ways to say it nicely that they also appreciate it. But that's what you have to work on.
Alright, I'll try it, and I'm probably going to get back to you.
No, but later. Is you have to work on how to say things that people are happy with.
Okay, I will.
Yeah. Thank you.